Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
It is remarkable how little details like soda machines, along with any number of other recurring props, can ground a game in a reality we recognize, he said. If video games are about creating a sense of place in which players can immerse themselves, something like a soda machine on a subway platform can go a long way towards making that happen. Those are the words of Professor Jason Morissette in a piece by our own Patrick Klepek called "This Professor Has Documented 2,000 Soda Machines in Video Games," and that went up this week. I'm Danielle Riendo. This is Waypoint Radio, episode 140. And joining me today are Rob Zachney.
Hello, hello.
And Patrick Klepek.
Is it soda? Is it pop? Is it soda pop?
Well, you're from the Midwest, so you say pop, right? Maybe?
Yeah, I learned to say
I don't
both.
I don't know. You say both. Okay.
Yeah, I felt like it switched when I was younger. Like, it was not necessarily one or the other. It was a lot of... I know that's usually pinned on the Midwest as one over the other, but I feel like I heard both when I was a kid.
That's fair. Rob, you're from the Midwest originally, so I don't know. You have the same feeling on this?
Yeah, I mean, like, when I was little, it was pop, like, all the time. And I think at some point I picked up that it was a regionalism and immediately scrubbed it. Like, I was like, oh, I can go anywhere and say soda, and, like, it's going to travel, and people are going to know. But if I go around saying pop, like, people are going to immediately be like, oh, so you're a Hoosier. And who needs that?
And who needs that? Well... Who needs that indeed, I guess. It's funny. I don't know. Regional, weird little regionalisms are very funny to me. But so are, of course, the main topic here, which I wanted to talk about minutiae in games. Not just minutiae, but like little things like this. Patrick, I think everybody was pretty excited about this piece. I got like three different, you know, I sort of share every story that's going up every day with like the wider Vice community. And like three different people DM me and they were like, let me know the second that goes up. They were very excited to hear about the guy who had documented 2,000 soda machines in games.
Yeah,
so.
This is only goes to show that sometimes you throw things at the wall and occasionally they stick. There are stories I write that I tell myself as I'm writing them, this is fucking fascinating. Like, people are going to be super into this. It's going to do good traffic. It's also a good story. And then you publish it and nobody gives a shit. And then you spend 30 seconds sending some questions off to a guy about these soda machines he documented. And everyone's losing their mind over it. So as just to say, as long as I've been doing this, I sometimes cannot tell the stories that are going to resonate with people in the stories that don't. But yeah, I remember I did a story at Giant Bomb. I think it was at Giant Bomb about like somebody that was documenting plants in video games. And there have been blogs that document toilets and pizza. So like the idea of following sort of otherwise innocuous or visual representations of real-life objects in video games is not new, but what caught my eye and what often catches people's eye is the number, right? It's the dedication that this particular academic has put into this side project to find 2,000 instances of it, which is a lot more than you'll usually see from folks that decide to go down a particular rabbit hole of this type of sort of documentizing and yeah, it's fascinating. I don't know that I have big takeaways from it other than it's interesting to see how different games approach this, which I think it sort of inherently has value in an industry that is very bad at documenting itself.
I mean, I remember one of the things that like made me go like, oh, holy shit, when I was playing the original Half-Life was it had working soda machines. Like, I remember like walking up to the you know, to this vending machines in the Black Mesa, like, you know, break room, and just, like, slapping that button over and over again and, like, hearing the, like, thunk of the can, and they start, like, falling out on the floor. And I think part of it is that it is such a ubiquitous and recognizable thing from real life that, like, we've all interacted with that, like, it's just something... It's just close enough to a real-world object that it gives us, like, a sense of, like, well, how closely is this game mirroring reality, right? Like, what do soda brands look like in this game? I'm always a little disappointed when the soda machine has just a big, like, cola sign on the front of it. Like, no. Give me a convincing fake brand. That's what I demand.
Give me Fizzy Fuzz Cola, please. Or something, whatever, you know, something specific. Well, that's a lot of it, right? It's sort of this weird specificity. And it's also the kind of thing I have always been, because I'm me, of course, I always love toilets in games. And I love, like, when, of course, immersive sim nerd loves flushing every toilet in a game.
It's definitely your love of immersive sims.
Well, but the thing is, that goes so, I remember... Rob, correct me if I'm wrong, because I feel like you may be able to speak more authoritatively than me on this. But I seem to remember the so like you, Danielle the metric you're using of whether you can flush a toilet. It really I think goes back to Duke Nukem 3D, like sort of the advent of the build engine in the 90s. Like Duke Nukem 3D was sort of like the beginning of, oh, you can interact with things in the environment and hitting this, like, part of the appeal of Duke Nukem 3D, other than being a teenager and it was a shooter where you could see strippers in all their pixelated glory, was like pressing the space bar on different things in the environment was half the fun of that game. Yeah. Like, it was a totally whatever, okay, fun, goofy shooter, but really, like, the thing I got the most out of Duke Nukem 3D was, like, I want to go see what the space bar does when I go up to the toilet. I want to see what the space bar does when I go up to a soda machine. I want to see what the space bar does when I go up to whatever other object, you know, when you go up to a stripper. Like, the part of the appeal of that game was, like, oh, like, this game was built around the idea that the environment is interactable, and you should... Rather than presume it does nothing, you should presume that you should experiment and see what it does. And Duke Nukem, at least in my own like video game history, like was the beginning of me thinking about video games in those terms.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And it's sort of something I always enjoy is whenever, even if it's the tiniest little thing, it just means that somebody somewhere on that development team thought, hey, it'd be cool if it makes a sound if you do this, or it'd be cool if this flushes, or it would be cool if this sink actually works. I mean, in Dishonored, there was actually value to this because there was a particular bone charm or whatever that would give you a little bit of whatever mana is called in that game. I forget. It's Friday. But it would give you like a little bit of power for like using the sinks or using the toilets. And it's like whenever that is made mechanical, it brightens my life. It's just sort of like somebody was thinking of me and the other, you know, seven people who care about this sort of thing. Like, oh yes, interacting with the environment is A, really fun and actually really puts you in that place in space. And B, whenever you make it actually something that, you know, enhances your experience as a player in a meaningful gameplay way, that is just saying, oh yeah, this matters. We thought of you. And that, it's special. I think it's special.
Yeah. And like in something like Dishonored, you get, you see the, like, what does a bathroom look like in this world, right? Like,
yes.
And it's weird to see, like, oh, so here's, like, a upper class shitter, as it were.
Yeah.
And here's what the lower classes have in this world. And, like, it's this, like, object that is clearly, you know what it is, but it's different from anyone you've seen in our world. But it gives you a bit of a sense of, like, again, what reality is like in the Dishonored world, right? So, like, in Dishonored world, you just grab onto a big ol', like, chain handle coming out of the floor when you've done your business. I think the other aspect of this stuff, at least, like, going back to Duke Nukem, the way it always felt to me, though, to my, you know... video game addled youthful brain at that point, it always felt like as these things were becoming interactable, it was sort of promising, or at least I was interpreting it as a promise that like someday this is going to be the holodeck, right? Like it felt like, okay, someday you're going to be able to go around this world and do all kinds of just normal everyday shit. And everything's going to be interactive and it will all like mean something. And basically it's going to be, what is it? The metaverse in Snow Crash.
But yeah.
As these things were made, you know, real in the game, toilets work, sinks turn on, mirrors at that point, like, you know, around that era, mirrors started having
reflections. Yeah, that was also a Duke thing. Yeah, it was mirrors, yep.
Yeah. It all started to feel like, okay, we are building, like, actual interactive worlds in games now. And I think that started to, it went away to a surprising degree, right? Like, now, increasingly, I just associate that stuff being done on a large scale with immersive sims, like you were saying, Danielle.
Yeah.
Well, cause, and that makes sense because, like, immersive sims, like, are doing world building through environmental design, and whereas Duke and games of its ilk, when they were incorporating interactivity, that was mostly a parlor trick. Like, that was, you know, the fact that the toilets flushed did not tell you anything. Well, I guess it told you something about Duke because the reward for finding something you can interact with was often a, like, one-liner as well. So in that sense, like, it was, like, part of Duke Nukem 3D's design. But, like, by and large, games that were incorporating, like, the flushing of toilets and things like that, it was mostly just a, like, a goof. Like, look at this thing we can do, as opposed to Dishonored, which is more the logical conclusion of that idea, which is that, well, actually, what we can do with this is try and say something about the world that we're building, especially in games that aren't, like, cutscene driven or nearly as narrative heavy in the more traditional sense. And it's not a surprise that a lot of games distance themselves from that because there are a lot of games in which the way the toilets look isn't necessarily telling you about the world or the game, or maybe that's just not part of its priority list. Whereas in an immersive sim, that is, you know, top five of what it's trying to accomplish.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. It's also like a very funny and weird thing. This is a half-formed thought, but I've always been fascinated by the mundane in any game. Any game that let me kind of go into somebody's bedroom and see what it looks like in there. Is it neat? Is it messy? Are there posters on the wall? That kind of thing has always been a point of fascination for me. Ever since I was little and just sort of, you know, the fun of exploring a game for me now and when I was little is always about those little things. Like how much care and detail went into these weird little things that I'm sure the developers knew not a lot of people would really pay that much attention to, but some artist somewhere, some environment artist somewhere thought, oh man, no, this bedroom is going to look like, this type of person lived there or whatever it is. And I am always here for that. I am always so interested in what little tiny character details or what little tiny world building details can be put into just the arrangement of art assets and whether or not something is or isn't sort of like a bespoke art asset, right? I've been playing Metro because, of course, we've been playing Metro and we're not going to talk about it a ton. But I definitely noticed in Artem's bedroom that he has like the Metro books in it, like the Metro. I don't know what the names of the books are off the top of my head, but I took a picture of it because I was like, oh, look at that. He's reading about himself, which is its own weird little thing. But it was like a tiny, tiny, tiny little, I don't even know if you would call it an Easter egg, but it was a tiny little feature that I am always very like pleasantly surprised to see in any game.
Memory serves, you're going to find copies of Metro 2033 in a lot of places. In the world. Like, oh, I need good, to create okay. the Easter egg asset. And then they're like, shit, we need some books. Well, we got this one textured. Cool. All right.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I always want to like sit down an environment artist and just talk to them about like, what's your favorite crappy bedroom that you've decorated? What's your favorite, you know, dinner table that you've decorated or whatever? Because it's those tiny little details absolutely go a long way in making me believe I'm in that world and or making me appreciate that world even more. I don't know if you guys have like a similar thing or if you have like a favorite general detail or item that you'd like to sort of look for in a game.
I have a deep appreciation for super high resolution textures, which is to say often with what you're talking about, sort of like the in games like the arrangement of objects and posters, yes, may have said something about the world or the character of that room, but to a certain point, often those were blurred in a way that they didn't actually have to provide a lot of detail in that poster. Like there wasn't like it, you could kind of tell it was an action movie or something like right. that, or you could kind of tell maybe it was a science book, but they didn't have to get granular in sort of like the world building. And so I think that's part of the reason that like a game like Gone Home really struck me was because it had what I craved, which was like the highest of high resolution textures and the and the smallest of details, because that's what I often was hoping for out of sequences like that in immersive, you know, starting with like Deus Ex was like, if I think of like the two games that I think about as a, when I was younger, games that interactivity like made an impact on me, it was Duke Nukem 3D and then in Deus Ex. And what I wanted from Deus Ex was like, I wanted to look at the books and read all the titles, but like they didn't do stuff. At least I don't remember being able to read all that. Like you couldn't go down a bookshelf and read all of that stuff. And part of, you know, part of that's logistical because what are they going to do? Come up with like thousands, tens of thousands of books to populate that stuff. And so it worked in Gone Home because they were building one house where they could like figure out the asset load for that. But I appreciated it because it was, I found it really enjoyable and enjoy that kind of world building where you can go through someone's shelf and learn a lot about them that isn't necessarily spelled out. And so I'm always a big, it's one of the first things I look for in games of that type is how high res are your textures? Because it says something about the kind of world building they're trying to do, where they cut off like the textures. Yeah. Like it really does. Like it says something about like the posters were going to have like ultra details and you're going to be able to read all of the fine print on that stuff. But the books, like, we're not gonna. Like, it doesn't matter how much you jack up the textures. Like, that stuff's just not going to be something you can read. And I always find seeing where the walls are on that to be, like, an enjoyable part of any one of those kinds of games.
Yeah.
It's one of the interesting things as well is that, like, there have been – a lot of games are running a lot more high-resolution textures. So you get things like a Call of Duty or Battlefield game where like nothing is interactive, basically. It's all various forms of like set decoration and wallpaper, but it's all hyper detailed. But it's hyper detailed to like no end, right? Like it's
just to be hyper detailed. Like that is the end.
Yeah. Right. Like you're going through like, you know, a house in suburban America during some sort of Red Dawn-esque disaster, right? But like you don't give a shit what the lives of the people were like inside this house. And it doesn't really look like whoever built that house really, you know, they just slap down like bookshelves, TV, whatever, and they rearrange it in different ways. But none of it is meant to serve any kind of purpose. And again, like if you look at a lot of like immersive sims, rooms are assigned to specific characters, right? Like you, like every single place you go becomes a tableau. Where you're sort of allowed to sort of puzzle together who used this room and why and who they were, you know, within this world. Whereas, like, if you run around a game like The Division, there are a few places where they use, like, the ridiculous number of high-res assets they have.
That game does have a lot of high-res assets. Now I'm remembering that. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, I get vertigo when I think about, like, how much labor and effort went into creating some of the like somebody must have spent a day creating like the chalkboard menus.
Oh yeah, the chalkboards in The Division are really good.
Good chalkboards.
They're beautiful. But somebody must have like lavished so much care on that. But in most places you go, it's literally just to establish like,
yeah,
this is a cafe, this is a bodega, this is an electronics shop. And it's very rare, but not completely absent from the game, where you'll come across a space that is somehow tailored to one particular moment, right? Or like one particular
It's
character.
Like really only like the main hub where like you get that particular kind of detail, but not in the actual like sort of environments you're going out and fighting in.
Yeah, I think occasionally if you go when you go into like the quarantined buildings, occasionally mm-hmm. you'll see like something that suggests a little bit of the life that was there before. But yeah, for the most part, it's all pretty anonymized. The other thing I'm a sucker for, and I remember like with Doom 3, I like Doom 3, by the way, but like
I'm with you. Sure. Doom 3 is good.
Right, it's not bad. It's not bad.
It's both not bad and is good.
Not bad and good.
What's real good is those interactive computer interfaces. Like mm-hmm. when in those opening levels where you had to like after all the shit. Hey, spoiler! Hell invades the Martian base in Doom 3. Yeah, it turns out you go and that one creepy like Germanic scientist dude not on the up and up. Just thought you should know.
Can't
After everything goes down and you have to make your way back through into the base and you have to like use a security terminal to unlock a security door. I remember, like, when the game sort of cues you to walk up to the security officer's screen, and that person's dead in their chair, and you just have to sort of reach past their corpse and, like, press the button on the screen to unlock the door. I was like, holy shit. Like, what an amazing technological feat. I've never seen anything like this. People will surely realize what a brilliant game this is.
It has buttons, in-game buttons.
They work.
Like, they work. They open the door. That's amazing. I love stuff like that too. I love interfaces within the fiction of a game so much. I love, you know, the Human Revolution, the Deus Ex game from a few years ago now, 2011 maybe, had real good terminals and real good emails. And that was probably my favorite part of that entire game, was reading every email and, like, hacking into every email and sort of sitting down, you know, as you do as Adam Jensen, and just typing, you know, kind of doing whatever the hacking minigame was. And you can see the rest of the world. You can see the shattered glass. You know, somebody's stalking you. Somebody has a gun out. And I was like, I don't care. I want to know about the hockey game that Bruno is going to on Friday. This is much cooler than everything else going on here, because it has this just, again, tiny bit of reality and that tiny bit of putting you into this world and looking at, oh, what does a computer interface look like in this world? It's so much fun. That, and I know probably a good old idle thumbs kind of call out would be like the 90s cockpit freakout, the like amazingly detailed cockpits of like star, you know, starships in,
Danielle,
in the 90s. Yes.
What if I told you there was a place where the 90s never ended?
Oh my God.
And it's the sim community.
Oh my God.
Like, that hasn't really gone away. That stuff
Perfect.
Still exists. Like, if you're making a Good. Serious simulation, you better have a virtual cockpit. Like, yeah, like, people are going to control it through hotkeys off their keyboard and everything. But if you're serious about this, you should probably be able to look down into the cockpit of your lovingly recreated A10 Warthog and use the multifunction display, vintage, like, 1978 with chunky little buttons. No, I mean, this stuff, like, is still out there. I think somebody made a simulation about a late Soviet or Russian surface-to-air missile system. And the entire game interface is you just looking basically at the dials and gauges that a surface-to-air missile operator would have sitting outside, like, the trailer next to this thing. And it's all just like analog displays and then a couple digital readouts and knobs and buttons that you have to like master if you're going to track, acquire, and launch on a target. It looks like the most, like, it looks kind of boring to me, but at the same time, like, damn, look at all those buttons. Like, that's an entire thing.
You can press them and they do things. It's like a weird, because it's another step removed from reality, right? It's not your hand touching a button, but like in game, your character's hand is touching that button and it's doing a thing. And for some reason, that's a weird, fascinating, disembodied, but amazing feeling that I love that stuff. I love dials and buttons and in interface stuff, which reminds me of Alien Isolation. One of the things I love the most about that game was the technology in that game, that clunky 70s or like 1981 era. You know, everything's analog. Everything's a little fuzzy. Everything has like a button to press or a gear to crank or something that needed doing, which of course played into the fiction of it's noisy and it's slow and it's not great. This is not like, oh, I'm aiming a device, a smartphone or whatever, hand terminal, whatever you want to say, at something and the door opens. It's, no, I need to make noise to pull this crank and the alien's probably going to hear it and eat my face off.
Everything needs a CRT the size of a bread box mounted on it.
Oh my God. Yes.
Game could have had more toilets.
It could have had more toilets. It did have great posters, though. Good posters, good magazines.
A lot of high-res textures in that game.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were beautiful.
I loved the little things like the advertisements for the the creepy androids.
Oh, the Working Joes.
The Working Joes. Yeah. Yep. Like, clearly, like, I love that in the fiction, the Working Joe is the rejected shit brand of android that nobody wants and is, like, taking the entire company down. Like, it is, like, congratulations, you ended up making the Zune. of androids. Which, hey, Zune wasn't bad. You know.
Yeah, and shout out to all the Waypoint Radio listeners that the last time I dared people to listen to it on a Zune, I got a endless stream of people who had hooked up their Zunes or have been hooking up their Zunes and listening to Waypoint Radio. So don't worry, they're out
there. Is
there
going to be Zune Mafia like knocking on my door soon?
I don't know. But there, I got at least like three or four different people that were like, hey, look, it loads your file. And I was like, that's good.
Listen, someday after like the apocalypse strikes, somebody will find your room and your abandoned Zune, and they will know everything about you.
From 2005, you know, yeah.
But yeah, so like, but the Working Joe is like this disastrous like piece of garbage android that everybody hates and is like openly terrifying. And all the ads for it are kind of like trying to lean into that. Like, well, what do we do with this? Like, well, you always know these are androids, and all the ads are basically like trying to make a selling point out of like our androids are fucking terrifying.
And it really is just like they work. Like that's the whole like yeah. It's really good. It's really really good. I mean, we could do a whole podcast on in-game advertising. Maybe we will one day. I think that, yeah, to use a term I try not to use, it's adjacent. It works. I wanted to talk a little bit about vending machines in general, not just for soda, but sort of as a general thing that you see a lot of in games, and it's fun to interact with, and it's fun to, because of course I played Bioshock again, because I did, and there's actually a sort of, in the, whatever, collector's edition of Bioshock that came out last fall, there are a series of documentaries, like modern, you know, recent documentaries done with Ken Levine and Sean Robertson, I think, who was the art director on that game. And there's a whole section on the vending machines and sort of how they came about and sort of the fiction of the vending machine in this world, like in this hyper-capitalist society. Of course you can buy ammo at a vending machine. It's freedom of ammo, whatever. You know, whatever. It's like this... it worked in the fiction, but also it was like a really simple device. Everybody knows what a vending machine does. You put money in it and it gives you something. Like it's a very universal kind of thing. I wanted to know if you folks had any sort of favorite vending machines, other than, of course, the soda machines. If there's other vending that struck your fancy at some point.
Gatherer's Garden vending machines had a terrifying theme song. That haunts me to this day. Like, that
always
was
growing.
Yeah, that was a bad. Like, it was good. It was evocative. But it was a bad thing. I'll tell you this: I hate the vending machines in Dead Space.
How do those ones work?
So everything in Dead Space is a diegetic UI,
right?
A diegetic UI. And so you go up to the vending machine, and basically it pulls up the same UI you have for everything, except now it's a really fussy inventory management / vending machine where you have to, like, carefully select what you have in your inventory and select, like, move to, like, put it in storage, or you hit the wrong button, sell it. But what you can't do is just get in there and just start moving stuff around and like really quickly like buying things. Every single thing is like a double confirmation transaction. It's super clumsy. But the UI stuff is generally pretty slick in that game.
Yeah, I'm looking through lists of vending machines. I'm trying to see if
anything pops out. I liked the vending machines in Shenmue as well. I'm one of those people who really liked all the capsule machines and vending machines and everything. You could get hot coffee in those. It was exciting.
I'm just a big fan of the entire genre of like merchant or vendor who shows up in places where there should absolutely not be a merchant or vendor.
Sure. Anyway,
again, like I'm playing a little bit of The Division. And, like, you just go up and a couple, like, U.S. soldiers have set up, like, literally it looks like a Girl Scout cookie drive, except it's, like, military hardware. And they're like, hey, buddy, you gotta see what I got. And it's, like, an M203 or something. And it's like, okay, sure, I guess money sure has value in this world right now, so you might as well take this and
the mysterious stranger from Resident Evil 4. It's like, oh, it's just very convenient that this man can open up his cloak and just sell me some grenades.
Remember, oh god. No, I can't remember it now. It's from the same team, the Killing Floor games.
Right.
And the merchant just shows up in between waves. I love that stuff. where it's like the world has literally gone to hell and somebody's like still trying to make a buck or two off it.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You know, capitalism dies hard. Yeah, real hard.
Clearly.
It's like in the Zelda games where, you know, in the 3D Zelda games, the bean guy is always like underground somewhere. And it's like, how do you make money, dude? Like you have 10 beans that you sell, magic beans, whatever, that you sell, and you're underground. So how are you making a profit? And he's also eating the beans the whole time. He's eating his product. I don't understand. I don't understand how this guy makes it work. But I guess, you know, it's a world of magic. So we have to kind of wave our hands a little bit. The last thing I wanted to note, and it's not a vending machine or anything, but I really loved the cheese in Perfect Dark. So the cheese was like a very random thing. There was a piece of cheese that showed up in every level in Perfect Dark. And I believe originally, this could be apocryphal, but this is a story I heard. It was originally somehow tied to like an achievement system of unlocking the cheats or something. But they abandoned that, but they kept the cheese in. And there is one level where there is cheese in a toilet. There's like a giant hunk of cheese, like Swiss cheese, just sitting in a toilet. And I always, you know, I was 16 when that game came out, and, you know, I'm still just as immature now, but I still found that to be the most hilarious thing in a video game. It's just cheese in a toilet. Somebody did not like this cheese, or maybe they loved it and they just stashed it in the toilet. I just always wanted to construct a backstory to the cheese in the toilet. I don't know if you guys have any weird things like that.
Okay, so I have a weird story. not about toilet cheese.
But...
And this was a photo I took on a phone that I broke like the next day, so there's no proof of it.
Oh no.
But in my old neighborhood in Boston, one day I come across like there's a pretty busy intersection right off Dorchester Avenue. And on the sidewalk is like an entire car bumper. Like the entire thing plus some of the frame around it, like just shattered and wrecked, bits of headlight, whatever. So clearly somebody had some kind of accident, except in the middle of it was a massive, like, OED-sized thesaurus. And I never, like, right, it was like, it was there amidst the wreckage, and to this day I'm like, did somebody just get rid of a thesaurus, like, at this accident site, or was there, like... a motor vehicle thesaurus like collision that happened like the day before.
Considering that this is Boston,
right?
I truly believe there's some Harvard student who thought it was, or whatever. There's 1,000 colleges there who thought it would be hilarious. You know, saw an accident or something, and like. Probably like circled something about, you know, unfortunate circumstances or something in that thesaurus and like threw it at the wreckage and thought they were like the cleverest boy in the world.
Well, they got me because I've spent about like a year and a half, 2 years like, trying to figure out like, so how was the thesaurus crossing the street? There was no blood. Was somebody hauling thesauri? Maybe that was it.
Wow. Environmental storytelling, Rob, it's a hell of a thing. Patrick, do you have any particular, you saw a tableau, whether in a video game or in real life, and it really made you think?
I'm going to start looking around my neighborhood for thesauruses, honestly.
They're rising up.
Exactly.
Wow. All right, well. I think it's probably time for us to dip a toe in the bucket, unless there are other amazing... amazing things in games that have done this for us. I don't know if I could top the thesaurus that got in a car accident.
I don't even drink soda. This is the thing. I don't drink soda. I drink a Coke Zero every once in a while, when I don't want to have a coffee at 4 o'clock, but I need some energy.
Yeah.
Me and my wife buy the
little
mini,
ones?
The tiny ones.
Yeah.
Wait, what?
There's like, they sell like,
there's like soda shooters?
Yeah, basically. It's basically doing like a big shot or like an espresso shot of like a Coke Zero. Because like sometimes on Friday, it's like if I got to go out and do a thing with like family, and it's like, like I'm tired. Like I didn't sleep well. My kid was up late last night. I'd really like after I've had 2 cups of coffee, like I really don't want like a third. That's pretty much what I drink. I slowly drink 2 cups of coffee throughout the day and I'm pretty much done after that. It's like, I don't want to drink a third cup of coffee at like 4:30 in the afternoon. So just sip that Coke Zero and if I had the whole can, I'd drink it. That's why I got to get the small one, limit myself.
Yeah. Doesn't feel like, I don't know, like when you're medicinally taking like a quarter of a Coke Zero, that doesn't feel like best life stuff right there. That doesn't feel like, another one for the books.
Well,
a little bit of judgment there, Rob. I don't know.
You know, I can't judge. Like, I'm not a parent. Like, I don't know how it gets.
Sometimes you need your shot of Coke Zero.
Yeah. I don't want to drink the coffee. Am I supposed to drink the coffee? What's my other option here?
Like, tea is a good option.
Caffeine pills.
Sometimes I've done green tea.
No. Like, regular tea, black tea. I don't think it's as caffeinated. So, like, a little orange, what is it? Orange.
Pico?
Yeah, that's a great one.
You could do Earl Grey, like our everyone's favorite. Captain.
Yeah, get on that 20s.
It's not everyone's favorite.
But. I think I'm going to keep drinking my Coke Zero.
Speaking of space captains, Elite Dangerous, good in-game UI.
Oh.
Like, yeah, you can use hotkeys, but if you look around your cockpit, and especially if you've got like some sort of head tracker, you can do everything. Using your head tracker and your mouse to sort of cycle through in-game like touch screens and menus, and your little pilot character will like reach their hand out and like make little adjustments on the spaceship, and you feel like you're really flying it.
Okay,
that's a game that I wish had a like just an hour experience version of Elite Dangerous, because I have the setup for that. Like, I have a VR headset, and I'd love to like fuck around with that game, but I don't want to play it. You know what I mean? Like, but I love all the trappings around it, and I wish there was just sort of like a 90-minute like, hey, like enjoy our UI and do it in VR and go land on a planet. But I also don't want to become a traitor.
I actually want somebody to just like, basically, I want it to be like, David Fincher and Michael Douglas is the game, but for Eve Online, where like I go in and like I think, oh, this is all real. I'm playing Eve Online, but really everyone around me is like part of an RPG experience that is like helping me like get the distilled like, yes, yeah. what core politics do you want to engage in? What treachery is going to happen to you today? And then like after an hour, I've like had the Eve experience and don't ever have to like mine 500 asteroids in the middle of bumfuck nowhere.
Oh. Fair.
Sounds pretty good. I would like that too. I would even put a VR headset on for that, and that's saying something for sure. I wouldn't risk motion sickness for much, but space travel, you know.
I would fall 20 stories through a series of perfectly placed breakaway glass panes for that experience.
Yeah, that sounds fair.
Really
sounds
learn like something about myself and life.
And the game, you know, all of it. All right, we have a question from Mike in St. Louis, and it's pretty meaty, so I feel like we can dive into this one. I also like how Mike paints a picture here. But anyway, here's Mike's letter. Hey, Waypoint Dexters. I grew up in the 80s and 90s, and my parents refused to allow video games in the house, scare quotes, until I was a teenager. Despite this policy, my parents were happy to send me out the front door with pockets heavy with quarters to play at local arcades, 7-Elevens, and pizza parlors. Sub-question, why don't we call more restaurants parlors? Done with that. And all of my foundational gaming experiences are inexorably linked to the arcade experience. Decades later, the cracks in the foundation have, I believe, made me extremely susceptible to microtransactions. Quote, well, at least I'm not paying every time I start a match, unquote, I say to myself as I purchase yet another skin or loot box. This leads to my question. While Noe wants a return to an arcade-style payment model for games, is there a game out there that you find good or addictive enough that you would pay to play on a micro level? For example, would Austin pay 50 cents every time he needed to send a pilot back in time and into the breach? Would you still play PUBG or Fortnite if it cost a quarter every time you wanted to jump out of the plane? Love your work. Hope everyone is doing well. Mike in St. Louis.
To answer question one, to speak as a parent who starts to think my kid who is a little over a year and a half, and I'm, you know, things like screen time and stuff are things that come up. I can understand. I don't know his parents, like, if they thought video game, clearly they didn't think video games were evil, and so if they were allowing them to go to the arcade. But I can understand the rationale they were coming up with by allowing them to go to the arcade, because it's, like, really difficult to tell to take something away from a child when they have access to it immediately, as opposed to the arcade is, like, a controlled – it's a timer, right? Like, here are your coins. Here is your time at the arcade. When you leave, like, no more video games, as opposed to an NES in the house is, like, okay, now it's, like, how are we regulating – your time with this, so you're not spending all of your time with it. So I actually think that was kind of till a teenager, I think is a little extreme, but I see the logic behind only the arcade for a certain period of time. Because I certainly run into this with my kid, where she wants to watch Coco all the time, and it's making me cry openly in front of her at random periods of the day, and she wants to watch TV all the time. So I get it. But anyway, second part of the question.
That makes sense.
I don't know. I don't have a game that I would. I think I've talked about this on the podcast before. I don't like spending money at all. Like, I'm a notorious sort of cheapskate. My wife is enjoys and is constantly irritated by the fact that I don't like to spend money. I'm the kind of person that goes to a restaurant, and even if it's a nice restaurant, the first thing I do is look at the prices of the food as opposed to what I want to
Coke
eat.
Zero.
I also buy the smaller Cokes because they're cheaper. Then I, from the restaurant menu of the ones that are in the cheaper category, then I will pick something that I would like to eat out of that. I try to break myself of that habit because I have the kind of money where I could just enjoy something every once in a while when I go out to a restaurant, which isn't often. And this is all to say, or like, for example, when we went, one of the only true vacations I've ever really taken with my wife, like, we've gone on trips, but like a vacation, we went all inclusive to the Dominican Republic a number of years back. And the ability to have an all inclusive where I didn't have to worry about, like, oh, I'd like to go get a beer or something. Yeah. Like, I could just go get it and not, like, think about that I'm spending, like, another $7. Because we were there for, like, 7 days, and it's, like, the idea of spending $7 every time I wanted to, like, get a drink or something like that would have driven me, like, just – I wouldn't have ended up enjoying myself or not getting the beer I wanted to get because I would have been worrying about how much I was spending. So even in a world – this didn't actually work out that way. But even in a world where I would have been spending – less by just buying the beers, my mental, like, logistics don't allow me to get to that place. Granted, this is useful for having a savings account and things like that, but
yes.
I also realize it as a sort of a mental tick. This is all to say, like, a large preamble to that's why I don't buy microtransactions, because I just stare at it and go, I don't need to buy this. Like, the act of spending money, like, bothers me, and so I need to spend it up front, get over it, and then move on. And the idea of, like, of spending, even if it's smaller amounts over a longer period of time, I just could not do that. I will just move on from the game. And I'm curious if other people, maybe not as irrational as I feel in that direction, but I wonder if you all feel similarly.
Oh, yeah. Like, 100%. Yep. Like, the moment a game is...
Well, you're a freelance... Like, you both have come from freelance life, yep. Right? Like, I've been lucky enough to have mostly full-time jobs in my work, but I have to imagine, as freelancers, that you have to have that mentality or else you're not going to make it.
Well, I mean, up to a point, but I also got really comfortable just saying, fuck it, I'll put it on credit, because pay came in late so often that after a certain point, if you're going to get a little thing like not having money stop you from living your life... then you're just going to be completely fucked. So might as well just put it on credit and then write the umpteenth pleading email to your editor. But as far as, like, the psychology of it, the minute a game like shows its hand that that's the business model. Like, no matter how much I am enjoying it, I'm like, no, I won't give you any money. Like, I actually like World of Warships. I enjoy like being a big old boat, just floating around out there, like blasting away at things, like sometimes with torpedoes, sometimes with like 14.5 inch artillery pieces. Who can say? They're both good. They're both fun. But the point is, I enjoyed that enough that I put in a non-trivial amount of time into it, but then I stopped playing it because it was turning into a grind. And at that point, that's where you really kind of like need to invest a little bit of money. Like, the game is literally like, look, just give me a couple bucks. Just a couple bucks. That's all I'm asking. And you'll, like, get an extra ship spot so you can, like, you know,
it's level free to play, right?
Yeah. But they limit – there's a lot of, like, convenience you're denied until you spend a little money. And I just refuse to do it. Like, literally, like, I could have just spent $5 and had the game experience be, like, immeasurably improved. And instead I was like – get your hand out of my pocket. I'm not giving you $5 for that. I don't care how big that boat is.
You did that because you don't know where it stops, right? Yeah. Like, it's one thing if it's a one-time, like, hey, if you just pay $10, like, we're going to lift a bunch of these sanctions on your gameplay experience, and, like, it's going to be cool. But the problem I run into this, and I imagine, you know, this plays into your own mentality and not wanting to pay that, is like, well, where does this stop? So, okay, I pay you $5. But then is it just, okay, 10 hours from now – I'm paying you another $5. Like, is this purely, hey, it's a free-to-play game. We have to put in some restrictions and annoy some players in order to make any money? Or is it like, these exist because we want to drive you, you know, up a wall to the point that you will pay money? Like, it's just, where is the authenticity of the transaction coming from? I think it plays into my, and yours, it sounds like, general proclivity to just not wanting to engage with it at all.
Yeah, from boat to whale is what it sounds like. What they're trying to do there to you, Rob.
I done fell out of the boat, Danielle. Take my credit card away from me.
I'm exactly the same way. I don't think I've ever paid for a loot box or any kind of microtransaction thing. I don't think I've ever actually even backed anything on Kickstarter, which is to my shame in some cases. I'm just like. Stingy as hell. Yeah. I'm just stingy. Like, I, you know, I was a freelancer. I did have a full-time job, but I also had student loans that are, like, past any human sanity. So, like, I've always been this way.
You were just going to say, like, past due, and I was like how long have they, like, you should probably do something about
that? I pay every month more than my rent and have for the last almost 10 years. It is bad. Anyway, don't go to grad school, kids. There's Mama Danielle's advice for life. But to be back on topic, like, it's that slippery slope thing, exactly what you're saying, Patrick. Like, I just, if it was $5, you support the developer, like, that's fine. I love doing that. Like, I will buy small games all the time just to be like, look, this developer's awesome. I want them to be able to eat and pay rent. Here's $5. But if it's like, all right, it's $5 today, and then, like, tomorrow it'll be $5, and then maybe next week, and it's almost like, once I go down that track, I don't know if I can stop the train. It's like this weird psychological, just bizarre sort of wall that it feels like if I break that wall, that's it. That's where ruin lives. Like, I'm going to be living on the street in a week because I won't be able to stop myself once that train gets – I don't know if that's crazy, but I worry about slippery slopes.
Well, and then maybe conveniently, or maybe this is the result of just habit, is that the games that usually ask these sorts of things are not – tend to not be games I find myself attracted to begin with. Like, that games like Overwatch are separate, because those are, like, relatively, like, newer phenomenons in terms of incorporating these sorts of economic approaches and marketplaces. But, like, a lot of games are, like, grind heavy. Like, I just don't play a lot of those games, and that's where a lot of that stuff tends to fall, because it fits pretty naturally with the gameplay structure. So often I'm able to avoid this trap to begin with, because it's either cosmetic based, in which, like, I've played 150 hours of PlayerUnknown's Battlegrounds. At no point, with the exception of, I think, the hot pants, at one point I thought about, all right, fine, I'll buy the hot pants, but the hot pants were going for like $200, and I was like, I'm not buying the hot pants. Like, if you wanted to drop a zero off that, like $20, I might have thought about doing it. It's just a one-time goof that would have been good for the stream. But generally, I tend to, like, because cosmetic stuff doesn't do anything for me. Like, I know Austin has, he spent a little bit of money on Battlegrounds, and his character looks dope. Like, it was worth, like, the $15 or whatever he spent on a game that he has gotten a lot more
Austin also
out of.
Approaches every game like a stage producer preparing for opening night. Like,
as someone that, like, specializes in, like, role-playing, like, it's not a surprise. Yeah. Like, I've done role-playing once in my life. It was the when we did it for that stream. And I had a lot of fun, but it's not intrinsic to the way I approach games and my interaction with them. So not shocking that Austin could both want to do something like that, but also cut himself off once he's, like, created the character, as opposed to, Danielle, like, your worry. And I think for folks that have psychological proclivities to, falling down that slippery slope, like, you know, not engaging with it once is preventing yourself from engaging with it, you know, potentially a number of more times that could materially be, you know, extremely negative.
Yeah.
What's interesting is that, like, you see a lot of nostalgia for the arcade model within, like, the FGC sometimes, right? Like, there's, like, a generational divide between players who, like, came of age and learned their craft playing in arcades versus kids, like, who grew up playing online, right? And, like, the arcades, there was, like, this scarcity element of, like, it wasn't just you lost your quarter. It was that you had to go to the back of the line and, like, wait your turn to play again. And there's this entire, like, idea that that churned out better and in some ways, like, more studious players in some ways, right? Because, like, to be heavily into fighting games in that era, you actually spent a lot of time watching people play and thinking on your mistakes rather than just sort of saying, boop, new match, here I go. And so that's an element that I find interesting as well, is that, like, there are entire genres that natively work on the arcade model. Like, the way they're sort of meant to be experienced down to the foundations of the genre is as this, like, you know, pay per game, wait your turn type model. And the form of it still exists, but the experience has completely changed, and it's completely changed the relationship you forge with the game. And I don't know, like, I could see that being fun if there were, like, a non-obnoxious way to, like, put a quarter in for a PUBG match or something like that, where it's not yet to be, like, authorizing a credit card transaction every single time that happens. I could see that being kind of cool, or just changing your relationship to the game a little bit, right? Where it's like, okay, now, like, I bought in. Like, this is my Andy. What am I going to do with it?
I mean, yeah, like, if it was really fun when we were at PAX this year, or PAX West last year, and then Austin and Danica and I saw a bunch of, this is in the midst of PUBG fever, and we saw a bunch of, like, Alienware machines that were set up, and they were doing PUBG matches. And, like, it was super fun and stressful to, like, be dropped in with a bunch of people who are around you combined with people who are playing online. And, like, the idea that I could, like, what if there was, like, an actual formal setup at, like, a PAX or something, or at a mall or something, that was just like, here are 100 machines, like, lined up in a circle. Everyone steps up, you plunk in your coin, it's like, all right, you are playing a battle royale with all the people in this room. Like, the stakes of, like, plunking down for that and then having physically people in the room or something like that, that there is something about that that is enticing, that would get me to want to play, like, pay on a per match basis. Because part of the fun of the, or part of the appeal of the per match basis is the and part of the arcade model is, like, the stakes, right? Like, you've put money in which you losing means you have lost that money or not accomplished a goal. Like, that's part of the fun, the push and pull with the arcade model. And so something like that could work in a certain context with a game like PUBG. I would never do something like that with me sitting at my computer. Or at least not in a way that I can fully rationalize, like, right now, or conceptualize right now. But, like, something like I just described, like, that sounds badass. If I could go to PAX and just, like, all right, here's $5. I'm in. Like, especially if there was, like, a pool, like, I could win that money the end of it. You know, like, something like that sounds, like, really fucking... Okay, there's that. if I could play PUBG and I could put money into it and I had a chance to get that money back,
that is
how I could see myself putting money in.
One of these days, somebody's going to open like just a straight up like land casino in Vegas or something, and then we're all fucked. Because then it's going to be.
Is there a law? Like, how? Why is that? Why can't I just put $5 on a match into PUBG? Like, there's got to be something, a reason I can't do that, right?
I mean, there are gambling laws. People from like DraftKings and stuff will tell you
that stuff's getting looser by the day, though.
It is. It's starting to loosen back up. But I think the main thing is like in terms of like doing that like in a physical space. The return you need on something
you have to
like
age
that,
gate.
What you're up against is a slot machine. Or a Keno, board or something like that, where like that just produces money for very little like time invested, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas like even if you're doing, let's not even say like PUBG, let's say it's like CS:GO or something like that, the amount of time it takes people to cycle through that for you to make your bank on that, pretty tough.
The whole bit that appeals to me about arcades, and that it sounds like would be amazing and appealing as well to you folks, is the social element, is being in a place with other people doing a thing that you like to do. And like, yeah, I would spend money for that, because it's in my brain, it's no longer just a thing for me, now it's a social thing, so it's fine to spend money on. I don't know why I have like weird categories that are like okay to spend money on or not okay to spend money on, but I totally do. And like, even if it were a, flat admission, $25 for a day at, 2 hours in the cool Battle Royale theme park, I would do that, and I don't even play that game. That just sounds like a really fun experience to have,
I'm just a jackass when it comes to money in general, though, right? Like, I'll stand there in the grocery store, like, comparing two rolls of paper towels, and like there's a 10-cent difference between them, and I'm like, I don't know what the best value proposition is here. And then like take me to a fucking cocktail bar in Boston, it's like, it's a $50 Manhattan variant, it's the house special, and I'm like, hell yeah, give me that, take this money.
it's what something has value to you, right? Like, who gives a fuck about the paper towels? But like, you want that best drink, you want that best drink, you want the best experience in your life. Oh my God. All right. The sub question though, I do want to honor this. Actually, first, before I go to that, we should end on the second question, the parlor question. So get ready for that. But I am thinking really, really hard here about, of course, like I don't have much of a relationship with grindy games, as Patrick was saying. I don't even have much of a relationship with Battle Royale games, to be honest. But like, if it were Prey, if it were something I fucking love, and it would be something that has incredible value to me, like, oh, Prey has a new mechanic. Prey has a new gravity mechanic where you can now, change the gravity in a given room, and it changes every system. And now you can play for another 25 hours, because I'm me, with every interaction you can possibly have now with that new system. Would I pay for that? And that's where it gets really tricky. Because no, I don't care much about cosmetics, and I don't care much about a lot of these other things, but like systems.
But that's just DLC at that point.
I think is a little bit
a different beast than
sure. I've always been happy to pay for DLC in games that I love, because it's like, oh, this is paying for another game experience, as opposed to something that is just sort of, I feel like for whatever reason I feel like this should already be part of the experience. It's like, no, this is actually cool extras, which I don't know if is an actual meaningful distinction, but there it is. That's how my brain sees it, I suppose. All right. So last question, not last question, but like last bit before we say goodbye here. Why don't we call more restaurants parlors? I think Mike is onto something here. I like the idea of like a taco parlor. Doesn't that sound nice?
Nope,
like
it doesn't.
You go to a no. All right, fine.
That sounds like shitty food.
Yeah,
you
want
to go to a taco parlor?
Here's the problem. Yeah, okay, no, a taco parlor.
I feel like that was started by some hipsters, and they're going to serve me some shit tacos.
Yeah, the problem is like the taco parlor is 100% being run by like Northeastern WASPs.
You're right.
Who like encountered a really good burrito once at this place called Chipotle. And like just really wanted to shit. Yeah. So like, no, taco parlor, tacos do not live in parlors. That's not where that happens. That's not where that's going to go down.
I'm sorry. I picked the wrong food,
but I think, and that's the problem, like pizza parlor, there's good alliteration. It's fun. Like it's a big place devoted to specialized food. Exactly.
Yeah. Ice cream parlor sounds really nice, doesn't it?
But does a cheeseburger parlor sound fun? Not really. Like, we need a whole parlor for that.
What about like a pasta parlor?
That sounds like a really shady all-you-can-eat buffet where I'm definitely going to, like, get food poisoning from, like, the ZD8. Like, that's how it's
going to
be.
You don't like the Alfredo sauce? Does it taste a little off to you?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like,
I don't know why it works for some things and not others, though. Like, pizza parlor, ice cream parlor. Does it have to be kind of junky food? Is that kind of what it is? Does it need to be, like, kind of, like, fun food? It's not, like, serious food? I don't know. What about, like, a candy bar parlor? That sounds nice. Yeah? I'm seeing some nods. I don't know.
I think parlor is a very... Parlor is our
saloon.
Word. Yeah, saloon too.
Saloon.
But saloon's fun. Saloons where like there's the little honky tonk piano, like player piano going in the background. Yeah. Like someone might get shot at any moment, and there's like spittoons everywhere. That's great.
And that's where you want to have your burgers, your burger saloon, right?
Yeah, like a burger place can be called a saloon.
Okay,
I feel like that's fair.
All right,
that feels like craft beers. That feels like a good
but
burger.
They need to have their liquor license. That's the thing. Like a pizza parlor doesn't need 100%. To have one.
Saloon is required to serve liquor.
Yeah,
yeah, yes, that makes sense. That makes a lot of sense. We should also talk about fake liquor in games someday, but not today because I think we're ready to wrap up. So, of course, I'll say the usual things. If you have a question or a recommendation for good kinds of food parlors, you can send those to gaming@vice.com with the subject question. As always, shout outs to Bowen for letting us use his track Miss You off the EP Pale Machine. We're on Twitter at Waypoint. We're on Facebook at Waypoint Vice and YouTube at Waypoint Vice. You can read everything we do at waypoint.vice.com. Patrick, where can people find you on this internet of ours?
Find me at the saloon over at Patrick Klupper.
Excellent. Rob, what about you?
At Rob Zachney on Twitter.
Honestly, Twitter is kind of like a fucking saloon sometimes.
It is a saloon. And it's a saloon where sometimes people throw bottles and sometimes they share bottles. And that's both of those things happen often on Twitter, where you can find me on the Twitter saloon at Danielle R.I. Thank you, everyone, for listening. As always, I would like to sign off with a be good. Or be good at it. Have a happy weekend. Enjoy your life.
Tofu parlor.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.